Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
What's good, internet? It is March 13th, 2017, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio. We are back from Boston, and when I say we, I really just mean me, Austin Walker, along with Waypoint's own Danielle Riendo and Danica Harrod. And also joining us, making this our biggest podcast yet, Patrick Klepek and Rob Zachney.
Hello, are people stuck in Boston?
No, actually,
I'm not you, but like, are people, I saw like lots of flights getting canceled.
Oh, shoot.
Well, the snow
is
not there yet. So
yeah, we missed the disaster.
It's not there yet.
Oh, okay, because it's snowing here right now, but we're not getting quite the dump that is predicted for the East Coast.
So the thing that's happening is your snow is going to hit our low pressure system, and it's going to be like, nah, we're just going to cover all
the
snow.
Yeah, because we got maybe
just snow.
Like 4 inches, but it's manageable. Like, it's not, you know, it's not really clumpy, but it sounds like you're getting the shit
storm. Boston's looking at over a foot.
Yeah,
they're saying 2 feet. 18 inches plus.
God, I'm so angry. I'm missing
taller than my child. Fine.
Yep.
Right. You have a human being who is smaller than the amount of snow we might get. Or who knows? Maybe this will be one of the many situations, many times, where they say, oh, this is it. It's the end of the earth as we know it. And then no snow happens at all. Maybe we'll get lucky.
Yeah, maybe. Fingers crossed. I mean, I'm fine with staying home tomorrow, though.
Yeah, me too, because I'm exhausted from PAX where we were.
Yeah.
We went up to PAX, the three of us. We took a road trip. We got a car from work, and we drove up, and we got a crib also provided by work. You can go see our video of where we stayed in Boston if you go to our twitter.com/waypoint. You should definitely do that. I really show new innovations in bed technology. If you really want to be on the
can I just
please,
I was just gonna say about that. I'm very proud of us because we originally had some producers who were going to come up to Boston with us. And then they were like, actually, Danica, here's a camera. You got this. And on our first night, we're like, all right, it's Cribs time, baby. And that was the best content we made all weekend.
It was very good. We do have some other footage that we need to do something with. I had the chance to talk to Jeff Strain, who is the founder of Undead Labs, which is making State of Decay 2. They'd made State of Decay, a game that I'm really fond of, despite some jagged edges, some sharp, less than finely polished elements. I really love that game, and so I'm really excited for this follow-up. And that conversation was great because it wasn't just like, obviously, he couldn't do a features list because
how many weapons are in the sequel?
Exactly.
How many?
I avoided.
It's give me a 20, round up.
22. It's 22.
22.
They rounded down. They went way lower. I don't know.
Interesting.
They're not 22. At least 22. I'm gonna make a bet. At least 22. No word on Claymore's yes or no yet though.
Big question.
So we had to have a chat with him, and then we got to play some stuff on top of all the panels that we did, and on top of Paxomania, and on top of everything else. Which was great. Danielle and Danica, is this your second PAX ever?
Yeah, so I've only been to PAX Prime.
Okay.
So PAX
West
East is pretty different.
Yeah, please,
PAX
don't look down to the other PAXes. Come on.
Yes.
So it was very overwhelming. It was like, I've been doing anime conventions for the last like 4+ years with Crunchyroll, and it reminded me a lot of an anime convention because it was just like very packed. There were a lot of families there. Lots of stuff to like buy on top of playing games. But it was pretty overwhelming, like walking with Austin in like a single file line because traffic was so heavy, and having someone like grab his arm and be like, can I take a picture with you? Like going the opposite direction.
That was literally the first thing that happened when we hit the show floor. It's nice to be able to see people. It's like, obviously we didn't have a panel of our own, but between, Paxomania, and then I did do a great panel. I was really lucky to work with Alexander Van Chestine, Tanya Short, and Catherine Cross on a panel about authorship and whether or not the intention of a creator matters in the work when it comes to interpretation, when it comes to ownership, when it comes to a lot of different things. We tried to be really multifaceted with that question. And I believe there is a recording of that panel that will go up somewhere. We paid to have a. I didn't pay. Someone who organized the panel. Paid.
We. That's a very. That's a very expansive use of the word "we," Austin Walker.
It was. It is. Well, what happened was I saw a DM in the group chat for that panel, and they said, "Oh, we should do this." And then I was like, "Oh, we didn't have that conversation." And then when I got there, the people who were they hired that they mentioned had been hired and were there to record it. So I don't know. I was near people who paid for it.
Yeah, that counts.
That counts.
And we all won. We all won at PAXmania.
That is true. We did all win our matches at PAXmania. Danielle and I were in the main event. We were the revolution up against the establishment, trying to make sure that those great tech workers who not the tech industry workers, the people who the technicians who allow video to go on screen during PAXmania, Video Game Championship Wrestling's own Kevin something was also among them this time.
Brian?
I forget his last name.
Brian
something. You're right, Brian, not Kevin. Yeah. It was Brian. Along with Adam and another guy whose name I forget. This is bad. This is a bad
I don't
look.
Know about this revolution, Austin. I don't know about the revolution. I forget their names.
Seems like someone talks a good game about the proletariat, but won't actually deign to know any of their names.
I know a lot of... here's what I
know. Back to your coffee shop.
Here's what I know.
Here's what I know. John Drake, like, broke his foot or something.
He tore his Achilles, I believe.
Yeah.
His Achilles for real.
Oh, that is
But
worse.
Not doing it any, like, let's be clear. That's an awful injury. It's a really hard to come back from. But my understanding is, I didn't watch this whole thing, but this is just what I've heard. Like, he wasn't, let's not, I don't want people to think he was doing something super cool. He just stood up and then his foot
jumped out. Yeah.
No, let's give you full context.
Yeah, he was jumping.
He was jumping up and down cheering because one of his vampire butler, their match, and then in response, John Drake jumped in the air and then just came down wrong on his foot. Shout out to John Drake. I hope your foot heals and that you get to live comfortably until then.
So wait, did it totally like window shade?
Well, I don't know what that means. I don't know that I want to know what that means.
There was a long pause after I've said that.
Okay.
We all imagined what that might mean.
I was like, I was waiting for someone else to be like, I know that reference.
Okay, so as I understand it, so there's a couple ways this can go, because I actually had my Achilles tendon reattached like a year and a half ago.
Yep.
So you can have your tears where like the tendon is injured, but it's still like doing its whole tendon thing, and it's anchored to the heel, which is awesome.
I hate the fucking next words coming out of Rob's mouth. Keep going.
But then it can also tear completely, and...
It was a full rupture.
Like, doctors will call it a window shade, because the muscle it's anchoring... is no longer anchored by the tendon, and it rolls up inside your leg like an old-fashioned window shade.
Oh, buddy. Oh, no. My synesthesia is kicking in.
Yep.
I hope John Drake is okay. I have to say, I was very proud of myself.
Yeah.
Because I got asked last minute by Aaron to be part of PAXmania, and I had no idea what... I mean, I knew what I was getting into, but I had no idea what I was going to do, and... was a bit overwhelmed because there's like all these really awesome people in video games and I'm pretty new to the like video game world and I kicked everyone's ass in WrestleMania 2000 and like
and to be clear really you were on Team New York versus Team Canada so you're a new New Yorker you're new to all of this and you wiped the floor with the pretenders I think is the real thing
it
to
was
say here
pretty amazing
yeah.
It was pretty amazing.
It was pretty good.
It was as if you had read the control sheet, unlike everyone else in that match.
I sat there reading the control sheet the entire show until I went on.
It's so smart.
That's the way
to
do it.
See, this is why you're Waypoint the Hedgehog. That's why. Because
I'm Waypoint the Hedgehog.
I can't. We're going to move on. But on top of the panels, on top of PAXmania, obviously we got to meet a lot of great fans, which was fantastic. And we're going to try to do something, I think, probably for PAX West or for some other event. At some point, we should really get all of us there and maybe
do
a panel.
We should have a
panel. Yeah, I think it's time. I think there's enough folks under the Waypoint banner at this point that we should get a table and sit at that table and talk about video games and other stuff.
Are we
going to
call it the Way Panel?
We'll have talks about that. We'll figure something out. That might be it.
Mm-hmm. I actually prefer the Viceland panel.
Yeah.
God, what am I doing with my life? What am I doing with my life? I did get to play video games at PAX, not as many as I wanted to, but the first thing I played. So here's a hot tip for you, convention goers, no matter what convention you have. My tactic is not to overbook anything, not to have like back-to-back-to-back-to-back appointments, because that's how you drive yourself mad, because you're going to be rushing from place to place and you're inevitably never going to make up you're not going to make it to each of your appointments. But what you should do is schedule strategically. So what I do is I have like a morning thing that ensures I will get up and get my ass to the floor where I know I can then make the rest of my stuff. Even if I'm a little late to my first thing, it means I'm going to at least get there. So the first thing I did right away was a 9:45 a.m. Mass Effect multiplayer demo with Danica. And we got to play a little bit of Mass Effect Andromeda together. What did you think of that?
I thought it was good.
You've played Mass Effect 3 multiplayer?
Yeah, I haven't played, Mass Effect since Mass Effect 2.
Okay.
So it's been a while, but sure. It was good. I played an Asari, and
good choice.
Yeah, and they added a lot of like improved mechanics and like some newer mechanics, and like you can jump really high, which was fun.
It's super weird that there's jumping in that game now.
It's so much. You go off so the ground. High.
Yeah, it's like jetpack jumping too. So it's not just like a little bit of jump. It's a lot of jump. And then there's side dashes that feel almost like sliding around in the Titan in Titanfall or something. Like very, very like firm side dashes. Between this and Zelda, the jump is back, baby.
Oh, the jump is back, baby. Hell yeah. They also added like a auto cover. So you walk up behind anything that's like obstructing your path, and you're going to automatically hide behind it, and when you hit the trigger button, you're going to aim over it.
Yeah, that's the thing that I'm like very curious about, how it feels in the single player, because I played a little bit of Ghost Recon Wildlands last week too, and I played the beta a while ago, and that also has that kind of like soft cover system where it just kind of knows if you're nearby, and then like, oh yeah, you're in cover, good enough. And I don't know if I love it. I don't know. It's like, I don't like a lot of binaries in my life, but what I do like is binary cover systems. I like to know I am safe behind cover because I hit the button that says you're safe behind cover. And so I'm curious to see how that works out. But at the same time, a thing that happened was you pulled a dude out of cover into the sky, and then I, as a Krogan Vanguard, just like charged at him in the air and blew him up and caused a biotic shockwave. And like, yep, I still like Mass Effect. It turns out I still like Mass Effect. So, I'm very curious about that game.
I wanted to ask, structurally, in terms of the multiplayer, because the third game, which I really liked the multiplayer in Mass Effect 3, it was I think it was a little bit underrated. It was actually pretty fun. I'm certainly not like the expert in online shooters or anything, but I played quite a bit of it. Is it structured similarly, as in like, oh, this faction versus this faction, and you know, kind of having the same general game types?
We only played one match of it, and it took like 15-20 minutes, but the way it was structured was very similar in that it was wave based and that it had objective modes on certain waves, right? So like round three was go, you know, decrypt this
capture the point, basically.
And then round six was go capture these six objects or devices or whatever. It was going really well in wave six. Let me tell you, we were maybe the best anyone's ever done at any game.
I have to say, no one's ever not made mistakes as much as we didn't make mistakes.
We made very few mistakes at all. We had a deep understanding of the revival mechanics and of teamwork generally. And then mysteriously, I don't know what happened, but the game disconnected. And so they forfeited. They saw how good we were doing, and they were like, BioWare was like, you know what? You just take the W on this one. You guys got it.
It said network disconnection, but I know that was probably just a ploy.
Right.
You know?
Well, it's like a network disconnection in the sense that whoever runs the enemy AI server back at BioWare HQ pulled the Ethernet cord from the wall.
Seeing how poorly they were.
We have to go back to, this game's out soon. We have to reprogram the AI, otherwise we'll never beat the amazing team of Austin and Danica. So,
Sorry, Danielle, what were you saying?
Did I
cut you off?
You go for it. No, you know what? You're another Danny. You go for it.
I was just going to say that one of the last things I'll say about the controls is movement. like, you move very slow. Like, the default movement is kind of, like, slow and crouched. And you have to push down on the right stick to just sprint. Like, go full sprint. There's no, like, in-between. There's no, like, just walking at a good pace.
Yeah.
And I wasn't super stoked on that.
that felt... I'm very curious to see if that's, like, character-based. Is that... you know, just part of multiplayer? Is that a thing I can switch in the options so that I'm always sprinting? Like, we didn't get a chance to, like, dig around that stuff. But again, we'll have hands on that in the full game soon. March is wild. Like, what... Patrick, you already written recently about how there are too many games coming
out.
Stop it.
Just don't even talk about it. If we don't acknowledge that the games of the next 30 days exist, then we don't have... They don't exist. They don't exist.
I mean, you've been playing...
Mass Effect's not out next week. Persona's not out in 3 weeks. Stop. It's just not true.
Well, Paul's from PAX talked to say briefly, like, you've been playing Nier. You've been playing Zelda. How are you feeling about those things?
Stressed out. Those games aren't done yet, and I have played nearly 20 hours of Zelda and only made it to a dungeon and said, I don't need to do that yet, and then just went climbing a fucking mountain again.
Do that dungeon. Which dungeon did you get?
Who cares? I don't... This game is not about the dungeons.
Trust me, you want to do the dungeon. You get a cool thing for doing the dungeons in this game. Patrick.
I trust you, but I will say briefly, I don't have any really sweeping pronouncements to make about Zelda as much as someone that if you listen to the podcast or things that I write about, like you're, especially given my life circumstances, I am usually very interested in games that are objective to kind of maximize my time. And Zelda, I have tried to... pull back from that, like, consciously, and I find that this game rewards it is rewarding in its own right, even when if you went back and bullet pointed what you did, you could easily say absolutely nothing, and yet over the course of that hour, we'll have a bunch of cool stories or little things that happened that were just part of the systems and the environment or things, some sweet vista that I discovered that is not going to be part of a, you know, it's not, doesn't check anything off my side quest list. It doesn't add a heart to my repertoire, but the fact that a Zelda game, which became so, you know, I like a Skyward Sword for various reasons, but its linearity was an extreme crutch, and it's like, it's part of, I think, the whiplash for this game, as it, from a design perspective, it was them saying, I mean, if there's any is sort of commonality in the criticism of Skyward Sword, is like, there's some cool ideas here, but holy shit, like, back off, Nintendo, like, you've gone too far down a certain path. And whereas Breath of the Wild goes in the extreme other direction where those checkboxes I don't need. I mean, obviously there's a cool thing in the dungeon. I'll do the dungeon. I'm at the front of it, and which is why I switched over to Nier to at least play something else. But I'm enjoying how much I'm enjoying this game despite the fact that I'm not doing the things that otherwise were the focus of any other Zelda game.
Yeah, I'm shocked that I'm still playing Zelda. I'm like hour 85 plus, maybe 90 by now. And like last night I was exhausted, but before I went to bed, I was like, I'm going to do a shrine or two. And also I'm going to say that in my head and I'm not going to commit to which ones. I'm not like going to say, I'm going to go do those two shrines. I already know. I'm going to give myself two shrines and I'll just, when I find the shrines, I'll do those shrines. And I ended up doing a really,
I got two shrines.
Oh my God.
Two shrines.
Great. Good. I'm glad this is my podcast. This is, it's a reference for me.
You
and
got the
me
whole
alone.
Team besides Mike. What do you expect?
That's true. The shrines I ended up doing was a cool labyrinth, like ruins thing that was great, which I won't spoil more. And then one that let me do weird electricity stuff and completely fuck around with their mechanics in a way that I don't think that they necessarily intended, which was great. So 90 hours in, I'm still fine. I'm only like 66, 67 shrines, and there are probably another 50 or something. So I'm shocked that I'm still playing this game, but
I feel like it's going to be a game that I am going to conscious, like part of the reason I played, I made it to the shrine, to the dungeon, and then switched over to Nier, because I think what I have to fully enjoy that game and what it excels at, I need to not look at it how I view other games, which is a game to finish, like, you know, in a quick... I feel like I will undercut what is enjoyable about that game if I put in my head, I need to finish this the next week before Mass Effect is out so I can move on to the next game, and instead treat Zelda as a game that I dip in and out of over the course of several months, so that in the spurts that I'm with it, I'm enjoying it for what it's good at, whereas a game like... Mass Effect is right. going to be more like Horizon, in which like, I can go from point to point. And I mean, I haven't played the new Mass Effect, but I presume, you know, everything indicates it is going to be within that realm where there's exploration, but it is not the exploration that Breath of the Wild is. And so that's a game like Nier or Mass Effect where I can jump into that, right. feel like I've accomplished something. But then when I go back to Zelda, it's a different feel. It's a different approach. And so it's like if I don't finish Zelda until sometime in April, like I'm going to be okay with that because I think otherwise I'll undercut right, exactly. what's enjoyable
and
about
that's
it.
That's the way to do it for sure. Otherwise, you'll just end up trying to rush through it and be miserable. How are you finding Nier so yeah. far? How far into it are you?
That is a fucking weird game. it's bizarre. I really only, unfortunately, so the stream I did last week, which the archive will finally go up, I think later today, I didn't play any of the demos, so I the part that I played was like the bit that your PlayStation lets you start jumping into as soon as it's downloaded some X amount of the game right. data. As it turns out, I guess that was just the demo, so it wasn't anything new for people who had tuned in. And then also, when you get to that point, the game just says, hey, why don't you go download that other 40 gigs? And I was like, okay. And then when I loaded it up this morning, I was like, well, I'll just pick up where I left off. It's like, it doesn't keep your save from the end of that section. And so then I had to spend 45 minutes playing the part that I'd already
cool part.
Played. Which fortunately, I was going to say, like, come on. Like, the first 45 minutes involve you, like, hacking the arm of a giant like oil installation that yells, kill, kill, kill. And then you rip off its arm and beat it to death with it. So you know what? Two times of that ain't so bad.
Ain't so bad. That game is interesting. I'm like 5 or 6 hours in. I think that the world is fascinating, and also I wish I'd played it before Zelda because I keep trying to climb walls that I'm not allowed to climb. I think it's really cool. I'm not like shitting on Nier at all. Like I think it's doing really weird stuff with the story. Here are the things I like about Nier Automata so far I'll just be as brief as possible. I really like that there is no like neutral perspective on the world. You play as an android who, and a very, very, mm-hmm. very light spoilers here. You play as an okay. So humans in this world, this is at the start of the game. I am so sure this will get more complicated as the game continues. But
you're gonna act like this already isn't complicated. I know. What you're about to outline.
Humans live on the moon because yep. aliens invaded years ago, and deployed machines to kill everybody. And so the humans retreated to the moon, built androids to go back to Earth and fight the machines to then eventually be able to get Earth back where they can then stage a counterattack against aliens. You don't see the aliens in the first 5 or 6 hours anyway, and you only ever interact with these machines that are not humanoid in the way that you are, or like they actually are kind of cartoonishly humanoid. They're like literally, in some cases, look like animatronics from an amusement park or something, right? Like bulbous, round, or like little toys, like the wind-up toys that look like they would just like shuffle from place to place. And then those robots, those machines, like gesture at the ways that humans interact in a way that's really grotesque and like extreme. So like, yeah, they'll yell kill, 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 kill. Or I saw one machine doing what looked like a sex at another machine. but not actually, I want to be clear, those machines aren't fucking. Those machines are doing what they think humans do or something.
So like, it wasn't a sex. It just looked like a
sex.
It was a visual sex.
It was like a pantomime, right?
A pantomime of a sex.
And that was weird, but the thing I like about all of this is that it's never like, oh, okay, of course, my position is like the neutral position from which I can see the world. Like, you're implicated immediately as an underling in this weird paramilitary group of androids being sent to Earth to fight on behalf of another group. Like, so you're always a little bit disinterested, but not like apolitically disinterested, like... I'm not even fighting for myself here. And I just love that there's no just like, oh yeah, the aliens are the bad guys. It's like XCOM is the inverse of this, where it's like, okay, I'm a human, the aliens are bad at the end. That's super easy to unpack. Like, fuck off aliens, I want Earth back. Got it. Easy. I like how complicated this is from the jump. And my understanding is,
well, you're not even including the broader context of like Nier and how this relates or doesn't relate, because I don't know. But like, go read an article that I put together last week that helps outline how weird and interesting Nier is, and the original Nier that came out for 360
also has androids
and PS3.
Also has like it's and
yeah, well, like that's what I don't know yet, like what the connection is between these two games. So spoilers for Nier, skip ahead 30 seconds if you somehow are going to go play that game for 45 hours, which you won't, so just listen. That game posits a world in which the humans you encounter, you later learn, are themselves robots that achieved their own form of consciousness and built a civilization. But they were created by humans who were killed by a plague. And so, like, are the quote-unquote humans living on the moon actually just the robot automatons that achieved consciousness from the original Nier? So they're not actually humans? They're
from the other... Because that's the other thing with Nier, is there are also geists on top of the robots that are different, that are the actual human spirits of the...
We're extracted from the humans that died in the ancient, like,
the
or rather
plague.
Our current modern
there's
time
also dragons
civilization.
Involved because it also connects to, yep. to Drakengard 1 and 3, but not 2. 2 exists in its own timeline. It's only connected by a novella.
Wait, this is related to the Drakengard series?
Yeah, Jaws, this is the same whole thing.
Wait, Nier and Drakengard are the same yeah. thing?
So, well, sort of. Wow. Like, Nier, there is an ending to the original Drakengard. This goes a lot deeper if you want to follow this rabbit hole, but the
I'm
basics
link
is that...
I'm going to timeline so that Rob can see, but you keep talking.
The end of one of the endings to Drakengard involves you going to a parallel or alternate dimension, which turns out to be like modern-day Tokyo, and that at the end of a boss battle, you on top of your... Do they call them dragons or dragon guards? I don't know enough about that series. But anyway, your dragon is shot down, you and the dragon are killed, and in the process, you end up... like, your body, which reacts weirdly because you are magical in property, it reacts strangely to the environment of this modern-day Tokyo, thus releasing a plague which kicks in the events of Nier. But it's not like... all endings of Drakengard are canonical to Nier. It is just like ending
just
5
ending
of 5.
E. Yes. Also, Drakengard 3 is actually a prequel to Drakengard 1, and that also only connects to Drakengard 1, not through any of the endings, but only through a novel. So it's...
great.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
I have a question about this timeline you sent me.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Is the word stage play?
So... Yes, that's exactly the part. That's the part where I'm getting stuck
I got
here.
Good news for you, bud, because there was video of that stage play, and that video includes lots of, like, women dressed as maids with guns.
Good.
And that's the immediate prequel to Nier Automata, as far as people can tell, or at least as far as people could tell before Nier Automata came out. I have not checked in on the fandom to see how they've reacted yet. People seem happy about this game, but...
So basically, like, Nier...
mm-hmm.
is like pushing the concept of transmedia to like the furthest
yes.
possible degree. Like this is the Star Trek of transmedia franchises.
Yes, accurate.
Good. Okay,
I'm not even sure it's transmedia anymore. It is just something its own. It needs its own term. It's called Nier.
Mm-hmm. Also,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, where does the part where Justin McElroy goes fishing fit into this?
Oh, yeah, that's the best part of that first game.
I think that's the origin story, I think. That's the okay. which is the cataclysm. I think that's it.
That was that video.
That video, exactly. God.
Also, Nier Automata is really fun to play. Because that was the big... it's why I would tell people, based on what other people have told me, is that Nier... is well worth understanding and going very deep down some YouTube and timeline rabbit holes, but then it is a slog to play. And that is not the case for Nier Automata. Like, it has very satisfying platinum-style combat that if you've played, you know, a Bayonetta or something like that, you'll quickly acclimate to. It's not, at least so far, you know, it doesn't have the depth of a Bayonetta because that's not what it's going for. And it has depth in different directions, but you're not doing a lot of, like, memorizing button patterns to string together elaborate combos. But it looks beautiful. It's a lot of fun to play. And I feel like between Horizon and Zelda, like, that game is going to get lost in a certain way. And so I've been trying to make a point of playing more Nier, if only to help give that game... what clearly seems like it's due that it requires, given all the other bigger games that are kind of surrounding
it. It's funny you say that there's depth to it, because there often literally is depth to it because of the way that the camera moves from being a third-person yeah. like character action game in the vein of Bayonetta to becoming a shooter, like a shoot-em-up style, like bullet hell.
Overhead, top-down shooter, yeah.
Or sideways shooter, or like weird isometric shooter sometimes. The camera does some really incredible things as that game continues. And it does that in the intro, but then it totally will continue to do that in boss fights, in like exploration segments. Also, the music is great. Like, god damn. Just check out that game. That game is
don't sit on it. And the PC version comes out later this week, which will probably, you know, hopefully be a good port of that game. But it's not like an overly taxing technical game, so my guess is that'll run pretty well on most people's.
I have one question.
Computers.
Yes.
About this game. All I know about it, other than the fishing stuff and, you know, just the general aesthetic of it, is butts. I know that butts are a very prominent part of this game. Is it distracting? Is it like...
I don't know that it's actually prominent as much as the fandom has made it.
I see.
Like, it's not something where you're... like. Whereas Bayonetta like makes sexuality like a very explicit part of its cinematics and the character of Bayonetta. Like, in Nier, like, it hasn't... Is it 2B? Is that the character 2B. That you're playing as?
I think so.
I'm playing and, like, the camera is often fairly distant from you, and there aren't, like, sweeping camera angles to, like, you know, show off her ass. And there's actually a trophy that scolds you if you try and get the camera to give you an upskirt shot. So the game seems like... aware of that. I don't know how much that changes. Right. Austin, you might be able to speak to that a little bit later, but it is not my, you know, if your worry is that character design is going to be like annoying and distracting, and I have not found that to be the case so far in so much of the game.
The images that you see going around of her like in like a swimsuit looking thing, or like a one piece, are only I think the way to get that costume is to use the self-destruct option, which is like an AOE attack that destroys your clothes. I've never had to use that, nor have I used it. And I also... I don't know. I don't know enough about the game yet to know if that also can work with the male character, 9S, who follows you around. I don't know if it happens to both of you. It's hard to say. I do wish... So Yoko Taro, who is one of the designers, I believe the lead on this game, who's the lead on Nier and the whole Drakengard, the whole Dragon Dragoon universe, is his brainchild. I wish he would be a little more... I don't know what the word is I want here. Like, I think there's something interesting happening with sexuality in this game. But when asked about why 2B is so sexy, his answer is like, oh, because I like pretty girls who look like
girls. Yeah, that was kind of what he said.
And
yeah.
I saw some people on Twitter who were being very smart about this last night. And I want to say it was Todd Harper and maybe Michael Lutz. Maybe it was Paris too. I don't remember. It's a bunch of smart people. We're saying like, that's better than completely dismissing that question, like, why do you sexualize your characters? But there's probably a way more interesting answer somewhere if pushed, which is like, that can't just be dismissed by, of course I make pretty characters. Because 2B is not just a pretty character, right? Like, she's a character in a leather dress with a blindfold on who can kill anything that moves and who, like, pushes around her, like, underling who is, like, a soft-spoken soft boy, right? Like, there's something happening here that is, like, I mean this seriously, that, like, that could be analyzed the way literature is analyzed. Like, there is a psychosexual thematical something happening there that goes beyond, oh, I like pretty girls. It's not Yoko Taro's responsibility to do that analysis for the reader necessarily, nor am I damning him for saying, like, I like pretty girls again. I think that's better than just, like, shut up, it's just a game. Like, at least you're fucking saying.
Or, like, Hideo Kojima's response to the, you know, the quiet design, like, dude, just embrace it. You want to make sexy girls and put them in your game. It's not necessarily fine, but at least I can respect that answer.
Right.
For sure.
Or it's an honest answer.
The other thing I'll say for 2B is I don't feel like she is sexualized by the camera, nor do I think that she's sexualized by the narrative in any way. She seems like a person, like an android. She seems like a character who stuff is happening. She's not just an object for the player to
She's honor. Not a sex doll with a butt.
No, that exactly. She's, like, she's I don't more think I've seen her that. Butt once yet. So... Which maybe that's my fault. Maybe I should use self-destruct so I can see that butt.
I've just seen that gif. I've seen that gif of, like, the water drying. I think maybe it's a mod. Or is that real?
No, that seems real because, again, but just I haven't done the self-destruct thing, so I haven't seen her butt get dry.
Well, you're going to have to do it for science.
I'll plug in the PS4.
You have to see her butt get dry.
I'll have to see the butt get dry. I'll check to see if the butt gets dry.
It's not wet McMuffin.
Yes, I was going to say, she had a big round wet McMuffin, but it dries.
A big round dry McMuffin sounds
bad. Yeah. No. It's a big round drying McMuffin.
Okay. I respect all the above. Like if you want to be horny in your game, go for it. If you don't want to be, go for it. I just wish. I just always want people to be thoughtful with all of the above. Like that's all I ask. Just be thoughtful. If you're fucking horny, that's fine.
Make an interesting
be
horny.
Thanks, Danielle. You know what? Own your horny. That's all. Just don't pretend that it's, you know, anything other than that. That's all I'm saying.
Great. So, Rob, you've been playing Dien Bien Phu, a game about the Vietnam.
Yeah. Here we go.
This is my pivot. Rob swore I wouldn't make him talk about a tabletop war game, and finally I found the perfect segue.
Yep.
Yeah. So, speaking of owning your horniness.
Okay. Good.
Good.
So... I was introduced this past week to Dien Bien Phu, The Final Gamble, which is a tabletop war game by Kim Conger. And my buddy over at Three Moves Ahead, Bruce Garrick, introduced me to the game. And I've kind of been in a funk lately because, like, I've been having trouble finding really good, interesting war games. Mm-hmm. It used to be one of my favorite genres, but, like, a lot of things about it have become kind of stale. A lot of it just comes down to sort of pushing troops around a board and watching, like, dice kind of roll themselves almost.
Right, so, like, what you're talking about here for, like, this audience who maybe has no idea what you mean by a tabletop war game, do you mean, like, looking like one of those, like... people in a tweed suit smoking a cigar, like, shuffling pieces around on a board with a stick, like in movies?
Not quite like that.
Okay.
So...
how many hexes are involved?
There's a lot of hexes.
How
there's
many
like
witch
so
hexes
many
are
hexes.
Involved? How many times do you hex your opponent because they've outsmarted you? And you go, hex on you.
Not witch hexes. Okay. It's a hexagonal board.
Not as good.
Yeah, it's a six-sided spaces. There's lots of counters. Involved, but it's a
like
war
alpha
game.
Counters, like in Street Fighter Alpha 3, or
not counters like that. More like cardboard chits, about the size of your thumbnail.
Would you call me?
oh my!
So the PC version of this, like a great war game on PC that like covers a lot of the bases, is a game called Unity of Command, which came out a couple years ago, which is It's a very distilled war game. It cuts out a lot of the complexity that a lot of war games are sort of bound up with and plays really easily, but still plays with those core concepts, right? Of like, here are your counters, here's your hexagonal movement, stuff like that. It's a great Eastern Front war game, highly recommended. A lot of war games aren't that simple.
Okay, so what separates Dien Bien Phu from the other war games, which are like very... in my head, like, when I have in the past watched or tried to play a tabletop war game, it means that I lose 7 hours of my life and often feel like I've never actually made any interesting decisions because the scenario has boxed me in to play one certain way, and it seems that every move, like, any troop placement or movement that would be made is the only possible one, or that like it's spiraled out of control because of something that happened 5 hours ago, and I don't actually feel any connection to what's happening. So how does Dien Bien Phu change that? Also, it's Dien space Bien space Phu.
Yep.
All right. Got it.
So it's super specific to this one battle. So Dien Bien Phu is basically. When the French were sort of in the final stages of their colonial war in French Indochina against the Viet Minh, which sort of later in the peace settlement became North Vietnam, but they're basically in a colonial war against a communist-inspired indigenous resistance movement that was sort of funded and armed by communist sponsors. So the war isn't going well. They need one giant battle. They're like, if we can just lure these bastards out into the open, we got them. So what do? We put everyone into the middle of this valley, and they basically say, come at me, bro. And It goes about as well as you'd expect. The Viet Minh have months to prepare. They surround this this airstrip series this airstrip and series of fortresses, and it turns into this really deadly like 2 month siege where the French paratroopers are trying to hold out against like massive waves of communist forces. The scenario is where it gets really interesting. So the communists, the two sides play completely differently.
Mm-hmm.
Core functions of the game behave completely differently.
So it's not just like, it's not just like chess or something where like we basically have the same pieces. It's not like Fire Emblem where like you and I basically are still just moving pieces around on a board in exactly the same way. We just start on opposite sides.
Yeah, no, you're playing almost different games. Okay. Like you have completely different things to consider. The big controlling factor for the French is that everything, like maintaining full like readiness so that you're fighting with all your resources, like artillery, armor. You're able to heal wounded infantry and get them back in the field if you have enough medicine. All the supplies that make that possible have to be airdropped in.
Oh, because you're not from
and so
there.
You have to
right because you're from France and like and you have bases that are not in this one space. You have bases that are off the map, presumably.
Yeah, no, you're in the middle of nowhere.
That's
like
really
you are
fucking cool.
Deep in the back country, and you have to get everything flown in from Hanoi, and. So you have to decide what goes on the planes. But here's the other catch. Weather can strike, or stuff can just go wrong. So not everything you load onto the planes is going to make it in. And so it becomes...
You then have to like do redundancy, where it's like, all right, I fucking really need more ammo for this artillery. I'm going to send three planes of ammo for artillery, or whatever the equivalent is. And then on... If the weather hits and one gets through, like, awesome. But then there's the other thing, which is like, oh, great, they all got through... And now I have more.
I really wish I had some medicine.
Right, I should have put some medicine on this plane. Shit. And then for me, this is why I like games in general, because it's so easy for me to imagine the on-the-ground dude at that airport being like, oh, thank God, we finally got the supplies. And then just like opening up all of the plane cargo doors, and it's just like huge massive artillery cannon shells roll out. And it's like, we need fucking food so bad. We're all so hungry. Why did you only send bullets?
That absolutely starts to happen in this game, and like it can have huge swings. Like there's some days where like pretty much every plane gets through, or there's possibilities. I think there's like 18 planes that move in every turn. There are possibilities that like 16 of those will not get through. Like
Jesus
it can
Christ.
Be like that feast or famine. So you're trying to plan around this huge like variability in what's actually going to reach you. And by the way, as you begin losing territory around the airbase, you start losing more supplies because your drop zone is shrinking.
Sure.
But the communist player has a different game they're playing. They've got pretty much limitless manpower, but they've got really fragile morale. Their forces need to like constantly feel like they're making progress. So you constantly need to be storming these French fortresses.
Uh-huh.
And you've got the numbers and you've got infiltrators, but as combat takes its toll, your forces start to sort of weaken. And as you get more more replacements sent in, which are like green troops, the morale of your units starts to decline like en masse.
Because
so
it's
you'll
like
have
new
entire
people who haven't seen anything before and who are just like terrified.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, pretty much.
War is
yeah, so
war,
you'll have
everyone.
Units. Yeah, you've got a lot of units on the board, but they're just not going to attack. They're going to abort their attacks the moment there's resistance. So it's this like each side has like huge advantages, but each side is like super fragile as well. And the dynamic, like each side's different strengths sort of play into the other's strengths. So there's some really interesting like clashes, right? So how much do the French want to put into saving an individual fort? For them, they can abandon that fort. It doesn't really matter that they hold on to it. But the problem is that if they hold on to it, that really sort of spikes the Viet Minh.
Right.
That really hurts them. So like how much do you want to put into that?
That's
and
really
so every turn is full of this stuff. And I've never played a war game like this, where it's like it is so specific to this one battle.
Right, that's the other thing, right? This isn't, again, the thing that separates this from, like, most other... When we think of, and I think most of our audience thinks of war games or, like, strategy games on the PC or again, things like Fire Emblem, it's about, like, having a generalizable gameplay system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Then you can reapply elsewhere. Like, oh, okay, yeah. Like, this is the basic rule set. Swords beat axes, axes beat lances, lances beat swords. And that means that we can deploy that new system on all these different maps. Or, oh, this one has a river. This one has, like, weird stone columns that you can destroy. But, like, basically, the basic gameplay is the same. And it would feel silly to just have a single game about one big battle.
Yeah, and that's kind of the funny thing that you see in the tabletop space a lot, where you've got these designs that are sort of specific to a given situation. And this is really unusual, especially in the wargame space, where it's like, this is a really interesting story, and we're going to focus on the things that are singular about that story. And that means the system can't be applied to, say, just any old, battle in history. It only works really in this one place, but boy, does it work. And every turn is just super dramatic. So this, it was a treat.
There's a really good Three Moves Ahead episode that you're not on, in which Bruce Garrick actually speaks with Kim Kanger, the designer of this game. I remember this because I listened to it in a Popeyes in London, Ontario in May of 2015 I was like a week away from moving back to New York to start a Giant Bomb. And it was one of the last podcasts I listened to up in Ontario. And it's like fantastic. It's like so good because it gets into all the details of like, there are questions when you design a historical game, especially a strategy, any sort of strategy game that has to deal with history, where it's like, okay, we know what happened in this war. We know, for instance, that the Allies win in World War II. How do you build a game that – do you build the game that makes it so that that is the natural conclusion of the mechanics? Like if the mechanics just played themselves out, so to speak, that the Allies would win? Or do you make a game that lets the Axis player succeed in ways that the Axis did not succeed historically? We know what happened in the Civil War. Do you make the game that replicates that exam that same structure so that the North wins and the Union is repaired? Or do you make a game that encourages both sides to have an equal shot at it? Like, how do you do that stuff? And that's a conversation with a designer about that exact question and what the kind of, even what the political ramifications are of trying to be neutral in that position versus trying to show a different historical position. Or like, it's a really great conversation. It's Three Moves Ahead, episode 305. I cannot recommend it enough. So really glad that you finally played this game, Rob.
Yeah, no, I felt like I was sort of summoning Everest while I was learning the game, but it was awesome, and I wish more games, not just war games, but like just more games in general, had this sort of like specific thought through approach to subject matter, right? Not just using a theme as a skin, but really unpacking what that like theme or that topic could lend to the game,
and then like sticking with that thing instead of trying to be like, okay, now that we have this core mechanic down,
it needs to be with mecha.
Well, okay, we'll slow down. We don't say things you can't fucking take back, Rob. Everything could use some mecha. One of the things that makes Nier cool is it sometimes just has mechs in it, just because. It's great.
Fair.
I think we should probably go to questions soon, but first I do just briefly want to talk about a couple of things I did see at PAX besides Mass Effect Andromeda, because I had the chance to go by the Annapurna booth. Annapurna is a newish independent publisher that's tied to... I mean, it's a film studio, right?
Like, Tribeca, right?
Is it tied to Tribeca, or is it... What's the... I don't know what the actual, like, heritage
Let's
is
take
there.
I'm going to take a look on the Google machine.
Sure.
How about that?
Oh, well, they were... They co-produced Todd Solondz's most recent film, so they've done some movies. They've done some movies I don't love.
They're behind, like, Foxcatcher and Spring Breakers.
Oh, yeah.
Zero Dark 30, yeah. I think.
Yes, that's correct. The Master. And are getting into games. And whenever this happens, I always feel really, like, skeptical. Anytime someone from a different media area comes in and is like, oh, hey, yeah, we want to figure out games. We want to do some game stuff. And it's like, okay, here we go. Like, what fucking bullshit licensed property are you going to make out into a platformer now? And then I went to that booth and played a bunch of games that I think are really dope. So that's a good feeling. I know, Danica, you and I both played Donut County, which is by,
yes.
Or is designed by Ben Esposito. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Whose Twitter name is at Tora Horse. And let me just pitch you Donut County. All right. Let me figure out the best way to do this. Okay. Think about Katamari Damacy. Is that how you pronounce that word?
Yes.
I think so.
Okay. Yes. Now, instead of being a ball, you're a hole in the ground. This should feel relevant because it's 2017 sometimes feels like there is a hole in the ground and it's swallowing us all up. And in this game, you are that hole. And you start by swallowing up little pieces of grass and trash, and then maybe a rock, and then maybe a chair, and soon you're swallowing up ranger stations in this rural place called Donut County. Or maybe it's not called Donut County. It feels like it's called Donut County.
Because you grow and grow with everything that you swallow up.
Exactly. Like in Katamari. As you successfully eat a small thing, you get bigger and bigger and bigger. And sometimes there's puzzle elements where it's like, oh, you have to knock over the things in a certain order in order to like get access to the thing that you can actually eat. And it's all really pretty. It has like a sort of a cartoonish, obviously the thing that jumps to mind right now is Night in the Woods. It's all animal characters who speak the way, in this pseudo-naturalistic voice, this sort of like internet talk that you talked about a couple of weeks ago, Patrick, where it's like, oh yeah, this is how me and my friends text, at least. And it really works, and it's really cute, and down in the hole, the people who have been swallowed are like trying to work out what happened as they sit 10,000 feet in the dark below the surface of the earth, like around all the other stuff that's been swallowed by the hole. And also, which is like, it's bright and colorful and there's really good music. And that was like, oh, this is literally the opposite of the sort of thing I expected from a serious film studio getting into games. That was the first thing I played there. And that was like, that set the stage that they are interested in that part of games also, the kind of independent space where bright and colorful things happen and not just the independent space where dour things happen. Not that that part is bad. I like dour games. So
one reason to be optimistic for Annapurna is that it's being one of the guys heading it up is this guy, Nathan Geary, who was the head of Sony Santa Monica's sort of like independent outreach division. Like he's that helped connect Sony with that game company, and it was one of the primary guys overlooking games like Journey. So there's reason to think that, and if you think about games like Journey and other games that Sony Santa Monica put out in partnering with independent developers, you can immediately see the same sort of lineage and taste in this. And so, does that mean that they're going to put out the next Journey? Who knows? But I think there's reason to be optimistic that it's not just a film studio like, let's get into games. It's like they found folks that really know their shit and are going to, I think part of what, how Nathan would describe his approach at Sony Santa Monica was to like, hey, let's make games that have no right to exist and put them out there. And I haven't talked to him about his approach to this, but my guess is that they're taking a similar approach.
That's what it feels like. So What Remains of Edith Finch, it definitely has that vibe because first of all, I guess it exists inside of a context of like what people offhandedly call walking simulators, where you're a first person character who's walking around and there's narration in the world, and it does the thing that certain games and films do where subtitles appear in the world, like kind of painted on structures or painted on a branch or on top of a fence or whatever as the character narrates. And the first thing I did when I started this game was fuck up and hit the escape key and bring up the pause menu where I revealed a family tree of the Finch family. And there were a couple of sketches of some characters, and I was like, oh, is this going to be a thing about like what's up with her whole family? Maybe. I don't know. And so you walk down this like creepy woodsy path as she's kind of narrating vaguely about like the death of a recent family member and how she hasn't been back to the house in a long time. And you come around this hill and look up, and there is this towering, like, it looks like something from Shin Megami Tensei by way of like British magical realism or something, right? Like it's like a dockside house. And then on top of that is like a natural extension from the house. Like, oh, they added a second floor. And then it kind of twists to the right a little bit. And now there's another house there. And then another one on top of that. And it twists back the other way. And it looks like Dr. Seuss, if Dr. Seuss committed to being scary a little. And then you go in there and you like sneak through the thing I just realized now, which is kind of interesting. You sneak through the kind of like doggy door and come back and come in. You have this key to something. You don't know what the key is to. And you start exploring the home, and it feels like a little bit like something like Gone Home, except instead of going through specific, you know, like opening books or reading like notes or anything, you're just kind of hearing your character narrate as she, Edith Finch, like looks around this house. And says like, oh yeah, my mom always said, don't go in the basement, or like, oh yeah, I have, you know, my grandmother and my mom always got into a fight, or oh, my uncle, whatever, used to work at the fishery. And that's why there's like tons of canned salmon everywhere in this house. And then you go up the first set floors, and on the second floor, there are six bedrooms, and each of them are locked and like sealed with glue, like hard, clear wood glue. And each of them has a peephole, and you look in, and it's like a room frozen in time. And then Edith explains that there was someone in her family who insisted that whenever anybody died, their room stayed exactly how it was when they died. And so then you start looking through the peepholes and like trying to figure out like what the fuck is this family, and you end up finding one room with an open door that has a copy of 10,000 Leagues Under the Sea, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, 20,000 Under the Sea. And it has a lock on it, and you're like, okay, well, I have this key, and you open it and lift it, and it's a secret door that opens into one of the locked bedrooms. And you go in there and then see a child's bedroom from like 20 years ago or something. And begin to live her last day alive. In which she is in her bed, and she's like, she then takes over as the narrator, and then it's the thing that they showed at E3 of this weird dreamlike thing of her turning into, this is really, she's in a bedroom, and there's a bird at the door. I'm just narrating my demo because like it's really,
oh my God.
There's a bird at the, or at the, not the door, at the window, pecking at the window, and, or like you can hear it out the window, and she's like hearing it, and then the character is like, I'm really hungry. I'm like so hungry. And then like she eats her gerbil's food, and then she almost eats her fish. And then she like sees the bird out of the corner of her eye and opens the window, lifts it and jumps out the window at it and turns into a cat. And the thing that happens here is like, it doesn't dismiss the following sequence, which involves her turning into a number of different weird animals while trying to find things to eat, including like hawks, where suddenly you're a first person hawk diving through like fields, like chasing down mice, or a shark who's like looking for seals to eat. It doesn't dismiss any of that as just being a weird dream. It eventually recenters, and you have to confront the fact that like the end of that character's, that weird sequence was that character confronting that she was like, she was holding in this unquenchable hunger, and then that was the day before she died, and whatever happened to her, and you don't really know what happened to her, and then you're in this house filled with all these other mysteries, and it was like, okay, like, yeah, I'm fucking in, fine, like, yes, yeah. I'm gonna play this stupid game. This thing that, like, again, back at E3 when they first showed the trailer for it, was just like, oh, now it's a hawk, now it's a shark, and it looked like really goofy, is actually fairly, like, serious. So I'm really curious to see how that shakes out. And then the last thing I saw there was Gorogoa, and I'll be very quick on that because I can't get the words right to talk about this fucking game. It's a point-and-click adventure game that happens in four frames. So your screen is split into four frames, and in each frame, or to start out with, three of the frames are empty, and one of them is a picture. It's a picture of, like, a guy, and he sees something out the window. I'm gonna invent a thing really quick to explain how this game works. So I'm just gonna say, like, okay, he needs to get a red ball. This is not from the game. I'm just gonna explain the mechanics through this example. He needs to get a red ball. And so to do that, maybe there's an arrow, and you hit left on the arrow, and he leaves that room and goes into the room to the left of it, right? And then in that room, maybe there's a picture, and you can zoom in on the picture, or you can click on him to make him go back to the right room or something. But instead, you click on the picture, and then you're like, okay, well, what am I doing with this picture? It's a picture of a clown, right? And then you drag, you go to, like, click on something and realize you're dragging the frame, and then you can move the frame of the picture frame into a different frame on your screen. and then zoom out and you're in a new scene in that frame. So he's, so the boy is still in the room where the photo of the clown is, and now you've zoomed out in a different frame to where it's a photo of the, it's a photo frame in the back of a circus where a clown is looking down on the ground sad, right? Or something. And you keep doing this and going in and out of these different subframes and dragging the sort of like framing object inside of the scene into different frames to recapture stuff and move it away. I solved a puzzle that had to do with temperature, but temperature and clocks and magnetism by like moving gauges around and magnetic objects so that they could see each other in different frames. I can't explain this game. It's really hard. It's a puzzle game. It's like a puzzle adventure point and click game that like made me a little nauseous to play because it felt like having vertigo and like, whoa, okay, there are a bunch of things happening that are layered in a really weird way, but every time I solved a puzzle, I felt like a genius. So
it sounds a little like the Esper machine in Blade Runner meets like an Escher drawing.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, like that. That's like exactly right. Like, but then again, also the art style is like hand drawn, very soft and very soft, but also it feels old. It feels like, you know, it's a drawing from 1918. Like, and everything has this like vaguely, I don't know what the kind of mythological connection is, but there's a very strange dragon, it looks almost like a feathered dragon, like you would find in Chinese mythology or Aztec mythology or something. It is really creepy every now and then. Like every now and then something sneaks in that is like overwhelming. So I'm really excited to play more of that. And it was just like one of those things, like I came to this booth, I almost didn't take this meeting, right? Like I kind of put off this meeting for a week. They'd been emailing me. I was like, oh yeah, they have some cool looking stuff, I guess. But I'm not looking to like have that meeting. And I walked by the first day, and the thing that I noticed, and like shout outs to devs who do this, they'd set up their booth such that it really felt like it was not on the PAX floor proper. There were plants there and couches and like what looked like good headphones. So it looked like I could actually go maybe play a demo there and not feel like I was being swallowed by PAX. and I just had like, you can hear the excitement in my voice of describing these games to you all because I played them 2 days ago and have wanted to talk about them ever since. It was like a really surprising showing from a publisher, and it's exciting to see new smaller pubs get into this scene, right? Like, I know what I'm going to get from Devolver at this point, and I'm going to get stuff that I like. I watched someone play Ruiner for 15 minutes, and Ruiner looks dope. Ape Out, they just announced Ape Out, a game that's like, looks like what if Hotline Miami was only three colors, and also you were a big gorilla, and also there was like free jazz drumming playing, synced to you playing. I'm like, oh yeah, that sounds like a game Devolver would make. So it's cool to see another publisher step up in this area and like do cool shit. So that's my excitement for the week, I think. Yay.
That sounds honestly amazing. I can't wait to play all of that. That all sounds like my jam. Capital letters,
all the way capitals. Ugh. Or just
do you know when it's? Do you know when Gorgoa is coming out?
Gorgoa. Is there a date? Gorgoa is coming out in the future. In the future.
I think it's sometime this year. That game has been in development for a long ass time.
Yeah.
I played a demo of that like 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh shit.
It's
okay.
Fucking. It's really weird. I don't know. Yeah. But it's worth playing. Oh, wow, that's really interesting. It apparently began as a card game inspired by interactive comics and, like, eventually became a PC game. So that's great. Good work. I'm excited to see how the rest of it shakes out. Like, who knows? Maybe I'll keep playing that game and hate it when it actually comes out. Like, maybe it'll get too hard because some of the puzzles were really fucking hard. But I really, again, felt not just smart, but it feels sometimes like casting a spell. Do you know what I mean? Ooh, or like doing a ritual, like, oh, weird. Like, oh, I figured out something about the way reality works that no one else knows. And that's a cool feeling.
Oh, that's intoxicating.
Have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing.
So, yes. I think it's probably time for the question bucket. Let's get a couple of quick questions in and then we'll wrap because we all have a lot of work to do today in preparation of being snowed in, except for Rob, who's not going to get snowed in because he is on the warm West Coast.
A nice place.
I'm actually regretful though, right? Because like, I always loved snow days so much ever since I was a kid.
They're great.
So yeah, like I've always worked from home, never had to go to an office. So they're always great.
I think I have a...
I might be on an ambulance, so...
Oh, no, that sounds...
My snow day might be very intense. Ugh. Yeah.
I have we'll a... I think I have to go into the office after this. I'm recording from home because I'm beat. And just to pick up some games that maybe came in for playing and writing about. And like,
oh, yeah.
Do I just want to go there just in case I can't go tomorrow because of the snow? And also because like,
a good thought.
What if I get snowed in and have a cool game to play? That might be okay.
Oh
yeah. Assume you won't be able to go in tomorrow.
That's a good point.
Assume that way.
Yeah. It's just such a pain to get to the office. Anyway, let's look at the question bucket. If you have a question that you want to get onto Waypoint Radio, you can write it to gamingadvice.com with the subject question or questions, or you know, just kind of have the word question in there. That would be good. This comes in from Mike in Glasgow, who writes, I was listening to the discussion about games you didn't complete because you wanted to be in the world longer. I had this feeling with The Witcher 3. After the main quest, all of the characters were just gone from the world. To me, it started feeling lifeless and dead, as all the people I liked in that place weren't there anymore. I couldn't just go visit Triss. I can't just find Ciri. However, I read The Witcher books, and it occurs to me that this might be how Geralt feels at the start of the game, considering some of the places the series goes. So in a way, me feeling like that matches the world and character really well and really makes me want to start the game over again. Or I could just play the rest of the DLC, but the world will be dead again. Has extra fiction outside of the game ever significantly impacted how you felt after your time with the game? Has it made you want to go back? How do you deal with it? Keep up the pseudopods, Mike in Glasgow. I think he means the ones of just like the weird side pods. I don't know. Or just keep up
side pods.
Keep up the octopi. Is that a pseudopod? Is a pseudopod is an octopus a pseudopod?
I think those are encephalopods, aren't they?
What's a pseudopod then?
That sounds like a gross sex thing from Nier.
Yeah, it's doing a sex in Nier with Andrew.
Yeah, I found some pseudopods.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay. So has anyone ever gone to exterior like a novel after you finished a game and are kind of like missing the world?
I feel like I have a weird version of this with Overwatch, in that I am now at a point where I'm much more interested in what the Overwatch fan community makes than what Blizzard makes about Overwatch. Like, I'm super interested in the comics and like the cool art that people make, but I haven't actually played Overwatch in months, and I'm totally okay with that. I know this is sort of the opposite of that, like being sad about something, but it's like, no, this is... I can see this, you know, really being a thing for folks.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Anyone who's, like, dug into... I guess here's a question for you, Rob, is, like, you've just played this game, Dianbian Phu. Are you eager to go, like, read about it now, about the actual historical battle, or are you content with your weekend, your tryst?
Oh, no. For me, wargaming and, like, a reading list go hand in hand, right? So, and you can't actually visit Bruce Garrick and talk war games without having books pressed into your hand on the way out the door. He's very much one of those people where he's like, oh, you haven't read this? Well, that's unacceptable. We must resolve this right away. He's a bit like a very giving Mr. Norrell in Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Usually those two things go hand in hand, and a lot of times they do enrich the experience quite a bit because you get a lot of context that would otherwise be missing. Right now I'm playing a Napoleonic war game, Scourge of War Waterloo. Not great, but it's pretty good. But what you wouldn't get from the war game that you do get from reading this book I'm reading, which is The Campaigns of Napoleon by, I think, David Chandler, is that it's very much like the last hurrah, the last ride. The entire campaign has this feeling of these armies that have been at war for about 25 years, and they're old, and they're tired, and nobody's really at their prime. And this is the last fight these guys are going to have, and it gives it this weird, like, kind of sad yet epic feeling, right? That, you know, everyone's best days are kind of behind them, and you wouldn't get that just from playing the game,
right?
But now playing those scenarios with that context changes their meaning.
That's really interesting. I wonder. I don't have to wonder. I've heard the same thing said about The Witcher from people who've gone into that game, having read a lot of the short fiction and some of the novellas and such, that like their understanding of Geralt and especially of like some of his relationships with those characters changes dramatically. I could see that being the case in a lot of places in games. Anyone else have an exterior thing that they connect to a specific game or a feeling of like hunger after leaving a game and being like, I need to scratch this itch elsewhere? Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah.
For me, I definitely.
More time. They're also like generally speaking, they just have not usually, you know,
like captivate.
There aren't that many worlds that left that mark on me afterwards.
You never looked at the Metro books, for instance?
No, because like my experience in those games was not about the large. In fact, like the storytelling in those games is pretty bad, and like the. But it's the atmosphere of those games is what draws me to Metro, not the actual. Like, if you actually like look at a Wikipedia summary of like the original Metro 2033, and then what they do in the sequel with like the supernatural stuff, it's bad. It's not good. Yeah. So I don't know. I generally speak, I don't find that there have been game worlds, and but I'm not. I also can't say there are necessarily a whole lot of like other media that, you know, with a rare exception of like when. You know, a new character is sort of debuted in a Marvel film that I'm not familiar with because I didn't grow up reading comics. Like, right. Sometimes I'll go back and read a couple of series to just sort of get a better sense of where that character came from. But it's not really something I do in games too much.
I have a quick side question.
Sure.
It's related, but sort of the inversion of this. Anyone ever, like, get into some, like, I don't know, call it side content or something in a different medium about a game that turns out to be more enjoyable than, like, the game it's related to, right?
Probably. Do you have something in mind?
Yeah.
Do you have a thing specifically?
I'm remembering that Halo Forward Unto Dawn series, which got me really excited for the direction Halo is moving with, like, Halo 4, I want to say. And then I was like, oh, you aren't moving that direction at all. Like, Forward Unto Dawn is this kind of interesting, like, Battlestar Galactica-esque take on what, like, grunts in the Halo universe are, like, would go through and what that story looks like. And it touches on a lot of really cool themes about, like, militarism and, you know, a societal elite versus, you know, sort of the broader universe they're exploiting.
And then, Halo. An ancient evil awakened, right? Like, that's a big skull man happened. So,
skull man.
His name is the
Yeah, Fallout
the Dida.
Shelter's.
Ooh, oh, Fallout Shelter.
Fallout Shelter's way better than Fallout 4.
That's an
interesting
one. I don't know that Fallout Shelter is actually.
That's a brutal claim. Oh, man.
I don't know that it holds up. I think Fallout Shelter came to the right place at the right time. I played a lot of Fallout Shelter.
But I hear it's a lot bigger now, though. There's more going on than there used to be, is what I
get. Maybe I'll take a look at it again. I don't.
All right, the Fallout 4 is just bad, so you know.
Yeah, I don't think it's that great.
I like it
to
more
be
than
honest,
most, but I'm not here to defend Fallout 4. I'll save my rhetorical bullets for another day, for other shit. I do the opposite thing of this, which is I have always like gone to games to scratch the interactive itch of an interest that I have, right? Like, whenever there was a new Gundam show out, I would go to play a mech game, not even necessarily a Gundam game. Like, oh, I really want to play Armored Core now because, you know, Gundam Wing 00 was on air at the time or something, right? Or I want to play Virtual On for that same reason. Or, you know, it can even be a little muddier than that even, which is just like, I was reading Kazuo Ishiguro's The Buried Giant, which has like a certain like high fantasy melancholy to it. It's about an older couple kind of who don't really have great track of their memories in a kind of Arthurian or like pre-Arthurian fantasy world, sort of. Like it's I don't know. There's a whole bunch of weird shit around that book in that like he insists it's not a fantasy novel because he's a real literary writer and it fucking pisses me off, but I still think it's a pretty good book. And because of that, I ended up installing the Shadow of the Colossus HD, like remaster, not because there's any direct analog, but there was a sort of tonal similarity of like lost memory and like ruins of a better world that no one could quite get a hold on. So I do stuff like that. I kind of go the opposite way of just like, I really want to scratch this itch with a game. I mean, this goes back to when I was like 12 and was like, would get up early to watch Dragon Ball Z and then rush to play Street Fighter Alpha on the PlayStation or whatever. And like, because that was the closest thing I had at the time to a Dragon Ball Z game. So it's deep. Let's do one more quick question, and then we'll wrap up. This comes in from Brian, who says, "Dear Danielle and staff, Legendary film critic Roger Ebert was often credited as saying, "Whether I loved a movie or hated it, by the time you're done reading my review, you should have a good idea if you'll like it." Do you think this philosophy of criticism is workable for video games? Film is different in that everyone who sees a film is going to see the same film, exception the theatrical release of Clue, even if they experience it differently. But with interactivity and customability inherent to video games, every person will have a unique experience. The reviewer who plays Hitman and never turns off the guidance will have a totally different reaction than the one who just starts throwing axes everywhere. Mario Maker was a totally separate thing for people with a huge Twitter following. Throwing levels out into the ether is vastly different than sending them out to 100,000 people already predisposed to like it and offer feedback. I guess what I mean is, are video game experiences too personal for reviews to be meaningful?
That's an excellent question, and it just sort of points to that games are just everything to all people and can be, and that's a great and wonderful thing. But I certainly think there's plenty of value in a review. I do also think, though, that it goes a little further than that. I think you need to sort of establish whose tastes align with yours sort of even before that. Like, you will know if a game is for you if I write this review in such a way. But you also kind of need to be familiar with, like, my work and my tastes as well. I do think there's a little bit of a broader context there that's helpful, but I think that's a perfectly good framing of it. I think you'll find people whose tastes align at least somewhat with your own if you do a little bit of homework and you look around a little bit, since there are plenty of folks out there writing about games at this point, which is a good thing.
And for that matter, you should do that with film critics also. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess it's interesting because this question actually gets at or towards, or kind of gestures towards, what Ebert's entire argument was against games as art, which I think is often maybe not unfair, like understandably dismissed instead of engaged with. But it's a little frustrating because I think it's important to engage with his argument. And his argument is this, is that, like, that degree of differentiation in play experience means that there can't be a relationship between author and reader or player, which I disagree with, obviously, but, like, that is the argument he's actually making, is that, you know, the famous example he gave was, like, you could play Romeo and Juliet was a game, you could play it so that Romeo and Juliet got together and lived happily ever after, and so that somehow spits in the face of the author, which means that the author's meaning is not conveyed. And that is one way of thinking about art, and I did a whole panel about why it's not the only way last weekend.
Yeah.
But I think that it's, for me, then the thing that this ends up wrapping back around to is, I think I disagree with the Ebert line that reviews, that the, or I guess he could do whatever he wants with his reviews. Like, if his goal was to convey the information about whether or not his reader would themselves like a movie, that's totally fine. But I don't think that is the standard by which all reviews or criticism or analysis should be held. That's one type of review that I'm glad is out there, but it can also be a hamstring to do that sort of writing. Like, when I reviewed Grow Home by Ubisoft a couple of years ago for GameSpot, like, writing in their style meant that I could only speak to its, like, key features and the way it executed on those, and not the context that I experienced the game in, which was thinking about Ubisoft's weird small studio pseudo indie thing that they were trying to do at the time. It meant that I couldn't really talk too much about the kind of, like, more than just the piece's effect of looking out across the world, because there isn't really a category for that to talk about in. And so there are ways in which different styles and guides actually constrain writers or encourage them to tackle things differently. Like, we get lots of people who are probably great writers who write in to us and say, "Hey, I'd love to write about blank," and all they want to say is it's a good game or it's a bad game. And, like, well, we're not going to publish that, because that's not, there are lots of places to write about that. We want a little bit more than that. We need a thesis of some sort. And so, like, different outlets have different interests. And I'm glad that we have the ones that we have, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I have a disagreement with, you know, or I think that other people who are doing it the other way are fucking up or something. I'm curious, everybody else, like, as readers, what do you look for in a review or in criticism?
Hmm.
Like, when you,
that's a big question.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I know what it feels like when I've read something I like, and that can be, the consumer driven, like, I'm glad I know about this now. I know I don't want to spend my money on it. Or it can
be. For me, it's a reaction or an experience, right? Like, so it's rather than checkboxing, like, you know, we joke about how many weapons or how many levels. You know, I can go to a website like howlongtobeat.com if I want to know how long it's going to take to beat a game. Whereas, you know, like in your write-up of Breath of the Wild, like, you know, there wasn't a checkbox. It was like conveying a sense of adventure that you had while playing the game, which I think is more useful as a device for conveying what makes that game interesting than it is to, like, and then here how many dungeons there are, and here's how the dungeon, you know, I mean, like, if those things feel like a natural part, an actual extension of what you want to say, that's fine. So, like, for me, like, I'm always looking, I'm someone that appreciates the author being part of what they write. And that doesn't necessarily mean telling, like, a personal story about how their dad died in, like, every story. That's just, like, conveying their experience with a game in whatever direction that takes them, because this is partially because I'm a deeply informed consumer, right? Like, there are different layers of people on what they're looking for, right? Like, maybe someone that goes to IGN or GameSpot, they're just looking for, like, oh man, like, is that new Mass Effect any good? Or, you know, should I just go play Zelda? And, like, there's something totally utilitarian and useful to that existing. But for me, as someone that doesn't need to know whether it's good or bad, I'm more interested in your reaction to it, and I can extrapolate plenty from there because I have the vocabulary and the understanding, and I've seen trailers. Like, so for me, as someone who's informed and appreciates video games as a medium and as goes beyond just whether it's good or bad, for me, in criticism, and this is true for all my, you know, sort of hobbies like horror movies and other things like that, I don't care if it's good or, like, I can extrapolate that from the experience or the reaction you had to it, and then I can sort of surmise what that means vis-a-vis me.
Does anyone remember a specific time when, like, critics were clearly split on a thing and you couldn't quite tell what you would think of something until you actually played it or saw it or read it? I'm trying to think of any, like, big divisive things in the last few years that were, like...
Well, I mean, like, you know, Far Cry 2 is a great example of a game like that. So we could get our Far Cry 2 reference in. That's a game that...
Idle thumbs right there. Yep.
Yeah, general, quote-unquote, consensus on that game was that it was a bad game. Or I think more that it was misunderstood. I think there are lots of reasons to dislike that game. Yep. That are legitimate if you don't necessarily subscribe to the things it does interesting. But I think that's an example of a game that if you were just to go look at, you know, the Metacritic or the reviews from a handful of critics that, you know, are not just people writing for IGN and GameSpot. And I don't say that to disparage those websites there were a lot of reviews that said Far Cry 2 doesn't work.
It's literally broken because I have malaria and my guns break. I can't complete this stuff. Yeah.
And instead, like, that was, you know, a small group of critics and enthusiasts, like, started championing that game and have tried, you know, over the years have, I think, shifted the understanding of that, or at least, like, been out there with the pom-poms. But I think that's a game that there was a... the way some people talk about it is so far removed than the way that it was sort of generally critically received.
Yeah, I think it's a really good example. Danica,
maybe Heavy Rain is another.
Yeah, Heavy Rain is definitely potential. One.
Any of the games from that dude are like that, honestly.
Yeah. Even Interior, like, even to me, even just my own opinions feel divisive about.
Yes,
game.
Yes.
Like, when I think about my time with Heavy Rain, there were lots of times that I was having a really good time. Like, a really good time.
There's some cool and smart things in those games, for sure. Like, the way they do mundane... We had a piece very recently about the way they do mundane actions, and it's kind of brilliant. And then there's also, like, stripping for no reason.
Yeah, that does happen, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
But that scene with the fucking finger is something
else. That's something else, man.
The party scene and beyond, great.
Yep.
It is awesome.
It's a good scene.
Yeah.
It's a good scene in Beyond. And then there's lots of terrible scenes in Beyond.
Yeah, like the desert.
God, that whole desert stuff. Oh, Lord. Both deserts. There are two deserts in Beyond,
yes.
I've just remembered, and both of them are bad.
Oh, God.
Oh, David Cage, what are we going to do with you?
That's the real question.
Have this same exact conversation later this year.
Except we're going to be way more frustrated because it's going to be his fucking Android racism game. So, okay. Yeah. I think that's going to do it for us. Let's go out on David Cage. Thinking about David Cage.
I hope that's the box quote that they put on is Austin Walker waypoint.
Close your eyes and think of David Cage. That's Austin Walker said it.
Oh wow.
Yep.
Oh boy.
That's it. That's
yep.
Ugh. Have I mentioned the thing that he said when I saw that game, when I saw Detroit Beyond Human? Is that what it's called?
Oh, please do.
Is that what it's called?
Detroit Beyond Human?
Become Human. Become Human or Beyond Human?
I think it's Beyond, right?
The fact that it's
because it was Beyond Two Souls, wasn't it?
It's Beyond Two Souls. It's Detroit Become Human.
Detroit Heavy Rain Two Souls, right.
Okay. I saw that trailer. I saw the Behind Closed Doors demo at E3, and after everyone was, oh my god, this good android negotiator saved that little girl's life. It's unbelievable. And then he said, I want to be clear that this game, I can't do David Cage, that's probably racist. Right. He said, I want to do his voice so bad, I'm not gonna. But he said,
I don't think it's racist because he's French. I don't think that's a
game.
I also just think the voice is going to be bad.
His game
so.
Is,
but it's all good. Yeah.
Not like Blade Runner, because you see, in this game, you are playing as an android detective who is good. And in all of the other worlds, the androids are bad. And so, unlike Blade Runner and RoboCop,
wow,
you are the android yourself. And it's like, which version of Blade Runner did you see, dog? Because I got bad news about Deckard.
That was a great accent, by
we
the
want
way.
To,
that was pretty fucking good, Austin.
Humanize the androids. We think that in the Terminator, they are the bad guys. But here, they are the good guys. And it was like, I can't be in this room with you anymore. It was really infuriating. And also, it's going to be about like classism and racism. So like, that's going to be good.
No.
Well, he's always had such a handle on the nuances of American life. I think if there's anybody equipped to talk about like postmodern, post-industrial Detroit, it's definitely David Cage.
What license would you like to give David Cage to make a game about? What, like
BioShock Infinite?
Oh my god! Why would you say that out loud? Oh my god! Could you imagine David Cage's BioShock Infinite?
I'm going for the most extreme thing that I can think of.
Oh my god.
And David Cage's BioShock note. Infinite.
There is always a lighthouse. There is always a girl. All right, everybody. I am Austin Walker. You can find me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Let's go around this virtual table real quick and see who else is where on the internet. Danica Herod, where are you?
I am on the internet 24/7. No, not 24/7. But you can find me at Danica Herod.
Rob Zachney, how about you?
You can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney.
Patrick Klepek.
Find me at Patrick Klepek.
And Danielle Riendo.
At Danielle or I on Twitter.
And of course, you can find everything we do at waypoint.vice.com, bazinga.zone, waypoint.dog.arf, digitalpyramids.com,
yep.
All the best URLs. You can find us on Twitter at twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice, youtube.com/waypointvice. If you ever have an issue watching one of our videos on the proprietary Vice video player, just go to the YouTube. They're there. You can watch them there. Be sure to go to our Twitter or Facebook to watch the incredible Waypoint Cribs episode that we shot while in Boston. I'm pretty happy with it, frankly. Thank you to Bowen for letting us use the song Miss You off of his EP Pale Machine. You can find out info about him at waypoint.zone/BOEN. You can go buy that song. That song is dope. Please give him money for it.
Woo.
And as always, stick around. We have some good shit coming this week, just like every week, as long as we survive the snowstorm, the impending doom of this blizzard.
Yes.
Keep us in your hearts. And until next time, peace.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.